Christ. And so we have the life of Christ here. I guess I skipped one of the promises. Back with the invasion of conquest, we have the land promise fulfilled, and now we have the seed promise fulfilled in Jesus. Well, Jesus, he is crucified on the cross. He's resurrected. He ascends into heaven, and he leaves the apostles to build his... And we have the record of the early church. And then finally, what do we close the Bible out with? The letters to Christians, or the epistles. Okay, well done. Well done, everybody. And what we'll study this morning, we'll continue our study in the patriarchs and, as I say, I hope, get into the period of the Exodus. Let's just run through the key dates right quick. I want to ask you to call them from memory, but just take some time to look over these a bit. 2000 BC, in other words, about as far before Christ as we are after Christ, is about the time that Abraham lived. The Exodus took place about 1450. Saul is crowned about 1050. The kingdom divides about 930, pardon me. Samaria falls in 721. We have the first first deportation, Daniel and other folks in his ilk in 605. 597 is when we have the second deportation. That would include Ezekiel. And then finally, all of Israel Judah is taken away when Jerusalem falls in 586. Babylon falls about 539. And then about 536 is when we have Zerubbabel and Joshua coming back. The temple, they finish rebuilding that in 516. 458 is when Ezra returns. And then finally, we have the walls rebuilt under Nehemiah in 444, 445 B.C. So, take a look at these dates from time to time. Commit them to memory. Help you remember, regardless of where you open your Bible to, you'll have some idea where in history that account falls. I won't go through all of these, but just if you can remember, we've talked about the 17 periods of Bible history. Creation, that period covers Genesis 1 through 5. The flood, Genesis 6 through 10. Just one chapter for the scattering in chapter 11. And then the rest of the book of Genesis is devoted to the patriarchs. I haven't put together a slide for the Exodus, but I'll put together a slide for the Exodus. And we won't go down to individual chapters, but it's, you know, if you can put some bookends on some of these periods, it's helpful regardless of where you open your Bible to. Oh, wait a second. That's in this period or that period. Alrighty. Matt tells me that we left off ready for number 16 in your notes. That covers the death of Abraham. And how old was Abraham at the time that he died? 175. Now, this brings me to a point that is easy to forget as you are reading your Bible. Who all was still living at the time that Abraham died? Now, we're jumping ahead in the story a bit because we won't get some of these numbers until later. But I put up a chart here to give you a feel for this. The way the Bible typically writes its story, well, I mean, let's face it, the way we typically tell stories, the default assumption is, if I tell you that one thing happened and then I tell you that another thing happened, the first thing I told you about probably happened first, and then the second thing I told you about probably happened after that. So we typically tell things in chronological order. But of course, especially if you have two peoples or two different events that are happening at the same time, you can't really tell the story at the same time. So you tell about one thing and then you back up. And you start back here and you tell about the second thing and then continue the narrative forward from there. Well, the Bible, I don't want to say it's not good about it, but it does not always make a point to say, okay, folks, we've gotten up to this point in history, let's back up to this point. And here's how I want to demonstrate that, in particular with the patriarchs. We have the death of Abraham here in the first part of chapter 25 of Genesis, and it tells us that he is 175. Well, how old was Abraham when Isaac was born? 100, okay. And he lives 180 years. So that means that at the time of Abraham's death, he is 75 years old. Pardon me. Now, he's 60 years old when Jacob is born. So that means that at 180, Jacob is only 120 years old. But look at this. Abraham is still alive at the time that not only that Jacob and Esau are born, but he lives for a few more years after that. Jacob and Esau are about 15 at the time that Abraham dies. So as you're reading the narrative, you have the death of Abraham at the beginning of chapter 25, and then you have the birth of Esau and Jacob at the end. But if you're not paying attention, it seems like those things happen and they're not connected to one another, or there's no overlap. So when you're trying to come up with a timeline here, you have to go throughout the record, and you have to find the ages. Well, okay, this man was this age here, and this man was this age here, and so and you have to do some math and cause things to, or try to get things to line up. Now, Joseph is a little more trouble. We do not have the age, at least if we do, then I've overlooked it. I don't think that we're given the age that Joseph, not the age that Joseph is born. I think we know what age he was when he was born, but we don't have the age that Jacob is when Joseph is born, and so we have to go from some other markers. Joseph is 17 when he is sold into slavery. He's 30 when he's appointed the deputy of the Pharaoh in Egypt. And then here's where we have to do the math. All right, he at the time that he's appointed the deputy, we have 7 years of feast, if you will, 7 years of plenty, and then we have 2 years, maybe 2 years and some change of famine, because if you'll remember, his brothers go down into Egypt and they come back, and then they go down a second time and come back, and then it's after that, it's on that second trip that Joseph reveals himself to his brothers, and then Jacob and all of his family come down into Egypt after that. So we're looking at about 2 years, maybe even three by the time they all get down there, but we'll just say 7 years of plenty and then 2 years of famine, and so that puts Joseph at 39 years old. Well, we are given Jacob's age at that point. He says when he stands before Pharaoh, the days of the years of my pilgrimage are, or the years of the days, one or the other, are 130. So 130 years that he's alive at the time that Joseph is apparently 39, maybe 40. But if we go with the 39 number, then that means that Jacob is 91 or thereabout at the time that Joseph is born, and Isaac is 151, and he's going to live almost another 30 years after Joseph is born, before he dies. And if you look at how that lines up there, Jacob and his family are back in Canaan sometime, it's hard to say how much, but for some period of time before Joseph is sold into slavery at 17. And so it's likely that Isaac was able to, well, I think it talks about his eyes being dim, so maybe he was not able to see Joseph very well, but he was able to meet his grandson Joseph before Joseph was sold into slavery. And yet, because he's almost 40 when it is revealed to his family that no, he was not killed by an animal, but he's down in Egypt and we're all going to go down there and join him, he's about a decade short of finding out the rest of the story there. So just wanted to put these things in here to illustrate this. One more thing I might mention. Now, I'm not quite sure how we get this math. I just didn't take time to do it. I'm not saying I'm suspicious of this number, but I'm just not quite sure how the math works out yet, but we'll go with it. John Gibson was mentioning that he was about 77, Jacob was, at the time that he deceived his father and then had to flee to Laban to go find a wife. And so just in case you were wondering, 77, unmarried, still living at home, the millennials do not have the market cornered on that right there. Yes, sir. Mm-hmm. Right. And he's there 20 years in all. I think that's where I'm having trouble. Well, exactly how does it line up? But it's somewhere around 77, 75, maybe somewhere in there. But when you think, I don't know if you're the same way, but I'm thinking, okay, here Isaac thinks he's at the end of his life at, if our math is right, 137. He's going to live over 40 more years before he finally dies. But he thinks he's at the end of his life when he calls Esau and says, "Son, I'm about to die. I need to bless you." And so here Jacob comes in, conspires with his mother to deceive his father. Well, he's 77 years old. I'm always thinking in my mind, the picture is, well, he's this punk teenager, you know, maybe he's 17 or something like that. But no, he's 77 years old and he's still trying to scheme, and undermine his father's plans. So, Just a little perspective there. Probably spending too much time on this, but I find this kind of thing fascinating, and I wanted to show this in particular to reset our impression of how long the patriarchs lived and how much they overlapped with one another, but also to illustrate the point that the Bible does not always tell things in chronological order. Jeremiah, in particular, is notorious. Now he does a pretty good job most of the time of saying, well, it was in this year of this king. So once we start an account in his book, then we can tell where we are at that point. But you may have an account in an earlier chapter that says it's in the time of Zedekiah, and then in a later chapter it's in the time of Jehoiakim, who was two kings before Zedekiah. So just pay attention to those markers and try to keep it straight as best you can. Sometimes it's a bit of a job. All right. Another thing that this is not in your notes, but I wanted to go ahead and mention it, since one of the goals of this overview is to highlight some of the types and shadows that we find in the Old Testament. Here we are in Genesis 25 when we have the death of Abraham. But I wanted to go back and talk about, just very briefly, an account of something that happened in chapter 14. If you recall, in chapter 13, Abraham and Lot separate. Where does Lot go to live in chapter 13? Sodom. Okay, so he goes to live in Sodom. And while he's in Sodom, before we get to chapter 19, where Sodom is destroyed, what happens to Lot? What is Lot caught up in chapter 14? What's that? Yeah, a raid, exactly. So you have these other kings come down, and they make war against Sodom and some other kings there, and take Lot, well, the people of Sodom, the people of Gomorrah, the people of, I think it's four kings against five, right? So the people of five cities there take them all back prisoner. Well, Abraham gets word of that, and so he takes, I think it's 300 of his trained servants, and they go after those kings, and they are so good, and I guess I'll say God is with them, that they are able to rescue all of those people from those four kings who came down and descended on those five cities, including Lot and his family. Well, on the way back, whom does Abraham meet? He's mentioned in this one place, and then we hear almost nothing about him for the entire rest of the Bible. Who was this guy? Melchizedek, exactly. So something to note there. If you take a look in chapter 14, you've got Melchizedek in verse 18 mentioned as the priest of God Most High. He received a tithe from Abraham. The lesser gives tribute or pays tribute to the greater. So here we're establishing a hierarchy, if you will. Abraham, because he pays tribute to this priest of the Most High God, Abraham is lesser than Melchizedek. And then finally, the greater blesses the lesser. So Melchizedek pronounces a blessing upon Abraham. And we establish this hierarchy that we mention here, and then there is no other mention of Melchizedek until we get to the Psalms. And it's just mentioned in passing. What significance does this guy serve? Well, we'll talk more about that in the book of Hebrews, but I did want to go ahead and point that out while we were here. Hated to miss this, and then get over to Hebrews and say, oh yeah, that guy Melchizedek that we never did talk about. So keep that in mind as we make our way over into Hebrews. Alrighty, number 17. When Isaac was 60 years old, Rebecca gave birth to twins. Why is that? Why do we have Rebecca and then Rachel, and I get those two mixed up, and then we have Samuel and Saul, and I get those two mixed up? Anyway, too many names of the same letter. So Rebecca gives birth to twins. Why did Esau sell his birthright to Jacob in Genesis chapter 25? I'm about to die. I've been out hunting all day. You just sit around the house. Give me some of that stew. And what is the point here? I'm going to jump ahead to Hebrews a bit, but what is the point that the Hebrew writer makes about the character of Esau from this one account alone? Exactly. A man of, were you going to add something? Irreverent, profane, irreverent. He takes something, his birthright that comes to him as the older son. He takes that and he's willing to throw that away because he happens to be a little bit hungry. Was he really gonna wither away and die? No. But this just shows the perspective that this man had. And we also see that highlighted, I think, as we keep reading about Esau, the women that he chose to marry and the way that they were a grief to his mother and father. So here we have the character of Esau beginning to be displayed for us, a profane man. And of course, that kind of behavior, it just gets worse as his descendants grow into a nation and will be from time to time will be a thorn in Israel's side. Yes, sir. Yes. Mm-hmm. Exactly. Yeah, no regard for the consequences, even though he regretted it later on. He sought repentance with tears, as I believe it's Hebrews put it. Well, on a different occasion, we have, as I mentioned already, Isaac at the end of his life. He says, I'm about to die, and so Esau, my son, go out and, hunt for me some of that game that you know that I love, and make some for me, and when you bring that back to me and I've eaten, then I will bless you. Well, Rebekah overhears that, and she doesn't want for Esau to get the blessing because she favored Jacob. She favored the younger, while Isaac favored the older. And of course, the lessons that we need to take from this sort of thing, we're going to see the problem here with Jacob of multiple wives, and that's gonna be a problem, in and of itself. And Jacob, unfortunately, is not going to learn from this lesson that we see here between Isaac and Rebekah and Esau and Jacob, the problem of showing favoritism of one child over another. Well, they conspire to have Jacob disguise himself and intercept, if you will, the blessing from Isaac. Of course, if you remember the account there, what does Jacob use to deceive his father? Rebekah cooks some stew, she prepares a goat, rather than venison, but she prepares some meat for Isaac. But then what does Jacob use to disguise himself? Well, it's a goat skin, right? So the skin of a goat. Why would he want to take the skin of a hairy goat and put it on himself? Why would that be an effective disguise? Very hairy. Esau was a hairy guy. That's literally what the name Esau means, is hairy. By the way, why do we call the people who descend from him, why don't we call them Esau? Why do we call them Edom? Because Edom means red, and he was apparently a nickname, if you will, that he picked up after selling his birthright in exchange for that red stew. So again, pay attention to the names and what they mean. They're rarely there for no reason. There's typically a life event or a purpose that person serves in the Bible story, and that person's name frequently matches up with that purpose or that event. So he takes goat skin and he puts that goat skin over himself, and he also takes some of his brother's clothes so that Isaac he feels him. He says, oh, this guy sounds like Jacob, but I mean, I can't see too well. Come here, son, bring me that meat. And he feels his hands and he feels the hair. By the way, what kind of a hairy man must Esau have been if goat skin feels like Esau? But he also has Esau's clothes on, and so Esau's clothes smell like the field. And so he's able to persuade Jacob, or Isaac rather, that no, this is in fact your son Esau, and Isaac pronounces that blessing on Esau. And so now not only has Jacob taken the birthright, but he's also taken the blessing. And we see the tears on Esau's part that follow later. Now, because Jacob has done this, by the way, what does the name Jacob mean? Supplanter, one who takes the heel, the idea that you're grabbing the heel and yanking it out from under somebody in order to get the advantage. Well, he has done just that. He has supplanted his brother Esau, and Esau's ready to kill him. So Rebekah says, you probably need to leave town for a while. And where does he go in order to flee Esau's wrath? And, oh, by the way, happen to find his wife. Yeah, but that's right. So he goes up and there we go. How about that? So we start out with, here's Bethel, and, probably down here closer to, Beersheba, I believe is where, Rebekah and Isaac and, Jacob and Esau were living at that time. So down here is where we start out. And he will, if you'll recall, as he flees heading, this is where Haran or Padan Aram are. That's where he will end up. But down here he flees and he starts heading north, and he comes to this place that we typically know as Bethel. But what happened at Bethel? Why does it even have the name? I'm sorry? Right. So this is the dream of Jacob, where the angels are ascending and descending there on the ladder to heaven. And so he says, well, this is the house of God. Typically in a Hebrew name, when you see that Beth, that means house or house of. Bethlehem is, I believe it's house of bread. Bethel, El is God. So when you see Bethel, house of God, Bethlehem, house of bread, a couple of other Beths that I can't, Beth Shemesh, I forget what Shemesh means, but keep an eye out for that sort of thing. Well, he ends up, as I say, up there in Haran, where his, and if you remember, Abraham had started out. I'll get my buttons right here in just a minute. Nope, not ready for that. Stop, don't look. We don't want to get ahead of ourselves there. If you recall, here's where Abraham started out, down here in Ur, and then he moves up here with his father, and that's where his father dies, is up here in Haran. And then after that is when Abraham moves down into Canaan. So this is where Abraham's people were left, and also Rebekah's people. That's where they were left, because they all come from the same stock. So he goes up to that same place. All right, done with that for the moment. Oh, let's see. Probably getting ahead of myself a bit. Let me also note something that happened in while Jacob was in Bethel. He sees this vision, and Jacob makes a vow to God there, and he says, God promises to be with Jacob. He says, I'm going to bring you back, and he repeats the promises that have been made to Abraham, the nation promise, the land promise, and the seed promise. He said, I'm going to bring you back to this land, and it will be given to you and your descendants. And so Jacob, he vows, he says, well, if you'll do that, I will give you a tenth of all that I possess. And so here God has made Jacob a promise, and Jacob in return makes God a promise while he's there in Bethel, before he ever makes it back to, or makes it up to Haran and meets Rachel. Let's see. Now, lots of other details we could go into, but how does the story unfold up there in Haran? We have Jacob meeting this woman, Rachel, with whom he is smitten, and so how does he go about acquiring her as a wife, and how does that story unfold? He agrees to work 7 years for her, and so then at the moment that 7 years comes to a close, they are married, and they live happily ever after, Jacob and Rachel, right? Not quite, right? What does Laban do to modify Jacob's plans a bit? Yeah, the old switcheroo. I'll have to tell you, y'all, I believe this story, but there are times I read this story and I'm thinking, I just don't know how this happens. And I wish we knew more details. I mean, how in the world does this happen? But anyway, somehow he's able to switch. I mean, was Rachel involved in this plot? Did they have her tied up and in a closet? I mean, how does this happen? So anyway, somehow he pulls off the switcheroo, as Jay says, and he finds that it's Leah that has been given to him as wife. And of course, Jacob's not too wild about that. And Laban says, well, yeah, we have a tradition. We have to marry the older daughter first, but just another 7 years. 7 years, come on, really. And by the way, just give her her week, and now you can have Rachel just work for me another 7 years after that. And in fact, he works that 7 years, and then there's another 6 years, I think, total. He works for Laban a total of 20 years while he's up there, and then finally decides that he's had enough and leaves. I won't go into all the business about how he took care of Laban's flocks and also his own flocks and how he amasses that wealth with God's help there. They start heading back after 20 years. They start heading back down toward Canaan. You know all of the children of Israel, so we won't go into that. I will say that on his way back, he gets to, I guess this is Peniel or Penuel is where he gets to, and that's where he wrestles with the angel, and he says, well, I've seen God. Now, he's given another name at that point as he's wrestling with the angel. What is that name by which we know him, and really by which he's known through most of the rest of the Bible? Israel. And Israel, I get conflicting remarks as I read about this name. I'm going to go with Prince with God. But the angel says you have struggled with both, or wrestled with both man and God, and overcome. And it's a little difficult to ferret out, okay, what exactly is the lesson here? The best I know to do with that is, look, you have struggled with your brother, with your father, with your father-in-law, by the way. Who was the trickster and who was the tricked in that case? Obviously, Jacob, who had been the trickster in the past, was the one who was taken in by Laban. So he's getting some just desserts, if you will. But here he is on his way back. God is fulfilling the promise that he is making to him. I will bring you back to this land and give this land to you and your descendants. And so perhaps the lesson is, look, you're wrestling with me. You're wrestling with man. Be faithful to me, and you will be a prince with me. Yes, sir. Yeah, Yeah, I don't know. I don't know. We're just not given enough information. And so it's hard to be too dogmatic about a conclusion there. Nevertheless, this is the point in which God blesses him with this name and the name that we know him and the people that will issue from him. All righty, let's talk about Joseph. Joseph is as we've noted already, Joseph is the favorite among the 12 sons. But the other sons don't care for this too much. In fact, what's another thing that rubbed them the wrong way? There was the favoritism that Jacob showed, and also, oh, these dreams that this guy has. Look, here comes this dreamer. And they just don't care for that too much. And so they take him, and they're thinking about killing him at first. But who stops them and says, no, let's think twice about this, guys. Let's not do this. Reuben. But then whose idea is it to sell him into slavery instead? We may as well make some profit off of this guy. Judah, which of course is significant, because Judah is going to show quite a change in character later on. Joseph, is down in... And by the way, something that somebody pointed out, they go back and they break the news to Jacob. Your son is lost. What do they use to deceive Jacob into thinking that his son is lost? What's that? So we take the clothing of Joseph, and we dip it in the blood of a goat. What was it that Jacob used to deceive his father? Oh, a goat and somebody else's clothing. But interesting poetic justice there, if you will. Joseph is down in Egypt, and what sets Joseph up? Joseph is a slave in the house of a man, and what gets Joseph into trouble? Is it anything that Joseph does? No. What gets him into trouble and lands him in prison? Yeah, Potiphar's wife. So the master's wife casts longing eyes at him and finally makes an advance on him. And when he flees from the house, she charges him with trying to assault her. And so he ends up in prison. But what does he do to distinguish himself in prison? And ultimately, after some passage of time, get the attention of Pharaoh. Yeah, exactly. So we have him interpreting the dreams of two of Pharaoh's servants who were also in the prison. Obviously, interpretations given to him by God. This was not Joseph reading tea leaves or something like that. This was God revealing to Joseph what these dreams meant. They came to pass, and then later on, the Pharaoh has a dream that Joseph is able to interpret with God's help. We mentioned already that Joseph was 30 years old when that happened. And it's at that point that, of course, the prophecy with regard to Pharaoh's dreams, 7 years of plenty and then 7 years of severe famine. And Joseph has an idea for how to alleviate that problem. And Pharaoh makes him a deputy at the age of 30. He is second in command over what is probably the most powerful nation in the world, in that part of the world at that time. Of course, there's a famine that spreads not just to Egypt, but also up into the land of Canaan. Joseph's brothers come down to get bread because that's the only place that there is such a thing. He recognizes them, and I love to go into that story some more and draw some lessons from that. But the long and the short is, once he is finally revealed to them, he wants to bring the whole family down and have them settle in what portion of the land of Egypt? Goshen. And why is Goshen so... I didn't put my... Let's see. We'll go back to... One more time. Why is Goshen so... Such a profitable land for them? Why would they want to live there? Yeah, Pharaoh himself calls it the best of the land. And as you can imagine, there at the delta of the Nile River, it would be a very fertile place for them to be. What is the Egyptians' view toward... Israel and his people because of their occupation? They were shepherds and... Yeah. And it's not entirely clear what this is about. Apparently, if you do some research into Egyptian literature, they just did not take a... They didn't have a high view of manual labor, menial work like this. And so because that kind of thing was repulsive to the Egyptians, they were able to go and live over there in Goshen and basically be off to themselves. Now, we skipped over it, but back in chapter 37, we have the account of Judah and Tamar and how Judah has two sons that he marries to this woman. They both end up dying. He promises the third, but never does actually give the third to her as a husband. And so she pretends to be a harlot, and Judah finds her along the way one day and sleeps with her, and that just not looking too good for the people of God here. And so I think the problem that we're seeing there is that the people of God are beginning to be influenced by the behavior and the character of the people in Canaan. So bringing Israel down and putting them in this nice land where they will be well taken care of, but also, even though they are in Egypt, they are some distance from the Egyptians. The Egyptians don't want to mingle with them. And so this gives them an opportunity to be by themselves and not to be influenced by the character of the Egyptians. I think we see God's providence at work here. So they will become a great nation. Pardon me, become a great nation. And then finally, we'll have the Exodus that we cover here in just a few minutes. Something to note. Well, you all know how the blessings work in Genesis chapter 49, but I did want to make one quick note of something. So here we've got the tribal territories. Once we have those divided up in the land of Canaan in the book of Joshua, where do we see the land of Simeon? Yeah, it's in the south. Yeah, exactly. So what they do, as we'll see once we get there, they draw lots, and Judah has the largest portion of any of the land in Canaan. And so later on they say, yeah, that's really too big for Judah. And so they draw lots for Simeon, and Simeon's lot, it takes its cities and its pasture lands from within the portion allotted to Judah. One of the reasons why this is all the same color is because it's a little tough to know exactly where the borders are there. And really, over time, Simeon just sort of gets swallowed up by Judah. You don't hear much about Simeon anymore. What about Levi's territory? Where is the large section of land allotted to Levi? Right, they just get cities scattered throughout, and we'll talk more about one reason why that's the case. But another reason why that's the case is among the prophecies that you read, the blessings, or cursings, if you will, that Jacob pronounces on his sons, Simeon and Levi had killed a bunch of men. Now, they were doing it to defend the honor of their sister, but Jacob just didn't appreciate that at all. And so he says, you will be scattered in Israel. And we see that come to pass. We see Simeon sort of swallowed up by Judah, and we see Levi not having their own place, one large territory to themselves, but rather they are spread out across Israel. Other prophecies we could talk about, such as the fact that Judah is prophesied as the tribe from which the lawgiver and the scepter shall reside until Shiloh, which is a prophecy of Christ, comes. And sure enough, Jeff is gonna buzz me here in just a moment. We better get into Israel or Exodus right quick. Yes, sir. Oh, yes. Yes, that's right. That's right. And so then that sets the stage for the Exodus, right? We have a Pharaoh who comes to power who does not know Joseph and what he did for Egypt. And I guess we'll talk about that on Wednesday. Go ahead and, if you will, surely covering the Exodus, at least up through chapter 18, will not take us all class. So go ahead and prepare lesson 5. Can't guarantee that we'll finish lesson 5, but, you know, we'll get as far as we can. Thank you for your attention and your comments.